You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Great War Revisited, Episode 3, The Anglo-German Naval Arms Race, The Long Shadow of Nelson. The last two episodes of this series have discussed the actions of Tirpitz and other German naval leaders as they sought to develop a naval power that would allow them to better assert Germany's interests overseas. It was impossible during the late 1800s and early 1900s to consider any naval plans or to prepare for any naval conflict without some discussion of by far the largest navy in the world, the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy was the navy, the largest, most prestigious, and most powerful navy during the 19th century. They had cemented this position during the Napoleonic Wars, and that advantage had never really dissipated. For almost a century, the British would be the undisputed rulers of the sea. During this century of naval dominance, the Royal Navy became a critical part of not just the British military and empire, but how the British people viewed their place in the world. There was no serious questioning, at least at the national political level, of the role and importance of the Royal Navy. And even when criticisms were leveled from time to time, they were more focused on the exact specifics of cost of the Navy, not around its importance to both the security of Britain, but also its entire worldwide empire. This did not prevent other nations from also building up their own naval power, but it was always clear that any navy around the world had very little chance in a war against the British Royal Navy. By 1900, there were a growing number of possible threats, though, and it would only be in the closing decades of the 19th century that other nations, spurred by Mahan's works on the importance of sea power, would begin to even consider seriously challenging British maritime control. The two largest threats would end up being Germany and America, but there would also be other countries that were instituting naval building programs, including Japan, France, and Russia. These new challengers had no hope, at least in the short term, of matching the Royal Navy numerically, but they hoped that they could challenge it qualitatively. We have already discussed some of the efforts made by the Germans in this regard, but other nations would be doing it as well, if perhaps not quite as antagonistically, with some nations making it a foreign policy goal to develop a close relationship with Britain, where any naval building would not be seen as a threat in London, which was the French approach. These new challenges meant that for the first time in almost a century, the Royal Navy would be facing ships that were qualitatively equivalent, and so they needed to be on their game. Even as far back as the 1880s, the questions that were being asked were perhaps, was the Royal Navy still capable of beating a peer-level adversary? There would be a criticism of the Navy at this time, and this criticism has only been agreed with by historians. A few of the charges leveled against the Navy was that it was kind of stuck in the past, it had let standards slip, and that the Royal Navy had sacrificed war-fighting capability and competency to make sure it looked good in fleet reviews. There would also be other criticisms that really just boiled down to the Royal Navy kind of losing its edge due simply to a lack of competition. These possible problems are mostly what this episode will be about, discussing the Royal Navy and its evolution between Nelson's victory at Trafalgar and the point in 1905 when Fisher would become First Lord of the Admiralty and institute wide-ranging reforms. During this time, the Royal Navy would spend several generations totally unchallenged, which caused it to lose something, perhaps, and perhaps even caused it to overall lose its way. The story of the Royal Navy in the late 19th century and the early 20th century would start way back with Nelson, and his shadow and his victories would stand over the service until well after the First World War. A Spanish tactician would write during the Napoleonic Wars that the Royal Navy was so potent during this period because, quote, an Englishman enters a naval action with the firm conviction that his duty is to hunt his enemies and help his friends, without looking out for directions in the midst of the fight. And while he thus clears his mind of subsidiary distractions, he rests in confidence on the certainty that his comrades, actuated by the same principles as himself, will be bound by the sacred and priceless law of mutual support. Accordingly, both he and all of his fellows fix their minds on acting with zeal and judgment on the spur of the moment, and with the certainty that they will not be deserted. End quote. In this quote, he might as well have been describing Nelson himself. He was known for his spontaneity, and it would be the key to several of his victories. Nelson built his fleet around the idea that once the fighting started, the ships would be, at least on some level, on their own. Therefore, before the fighting began, the officers on all the ships needed to discuss and decide what the best course of action would be in certain situations. Then this would allow them all to come to roughly the same conclusions when the fighting had started. This setup was good in theory and in practice, especially given the communication restrictions at that time. It was also particularly effective during the Napoleonic Wars due to their length. By the time of Nelson's great victory at Trafalgar, the Royal Navy had been in a state of war with France for almost a decade. This provided a level of experience in both men and the officers that would not even be approached until maybe the end of the Second World War. This experience would be one of the factors that would lead the Royal Navy to victory, first at Trafalgar and then in the wars with France more generally. When those wars were over, though, the Royal Navy was left without a major navy to fight. Without new threats and new action, the experience advantage would decay and then disappear, and the Navy was left with its legacy and would live for the next century in the shadow of great victories. They would also spend the next century looking back, relitigating Nelson's decisions and actions, and in those gazes into the past, they would very precisely determine what had happened, and they may have began to get a bit fuzzy on why they happened. After the final defeat of Napoleon, the French Navy would still be the second largest in the world, until almost the end of the 19th century. There would be a few threats from the French and others as they introduced new building programs, but the British dominance was never seriously threatened. During the major wars of the 19th century, like the Crimean War, the American Civil War, the Austro-Italian War of 1866, just kind of to name a few there, there would be no major fleet actions for the Royal Navy. This would cause a serious problem for that navy. How could it continue to justify its own expense? The seriousness of that question would ebb and flow based on the economic circumstances, but it would always be present. The area hit hardest by these budgetary questions was always innovation and modernization. This meant that by the 1880s, the Royal Navy was a hodgepodge of different ship types, built in different eras with different capabilities. Almost all the major technological leaps since the introduction of ironclads in the 1860s were still represented in the late 1880s. During these decades, steam power came into its own, and it rapidly matured, and the capabilities of the ships that were powered by steam engines quickly evolved. Such rapid change meant that many of the ships which were theoretically in the Royal Navy, in a fleet together, had vastly different abilities in terms of speed, endurance, and striking power. This made coherent fleet actions a real challenge, but since they were never really needed, it would never be a big enough problem that justified the money to solve it. But these aging and very sort of heterogeneous ships that the Royal Navy was working with was really just indicative of another problem. And I really like this little quote from The Rules of the Game, Jutland and British Naval Command by Andrew Gordon and Paul Wilderson, the first half of which functions as a kind of a lengthy critique of the Royal Navy during the 19th century. But they would have this to say, and I love this quote. Quote, by the close of the Victorian age, British officer classes were increasingly the inheritors and not the winners of empire, end quote. The officers of the Royal Navy, without a major threat to face, moved into a lengthy period of complacency, which was not at all assisted by the fact that officer training was, well, pretty bad during this period. The ineffective training was then combined with an overall lack of encouragement for people to learn anything about tactics and strategy. And this meant that generations of officers were focused more on everything except for making sure their ships could perform well in a combat situation. This can be a real challenge for any military during peacetime, because the types of attributes and skills that make a military capable of winning wars are not always the same set of attributes and skills that are required for a peacetime force. The Royal Navy would also strongly adhere to a seniority system, which would be a problem as the pace of technological change accelerated in the late 19th century. As military naval vessels grew in technological complexity, the old system of seniority and officer training fell apart, as a whole range of true specialists would be required to make sure the ship was running at tip-top shape, or was running at all. This became more important as time passed, ships grew larger, and the amount of knowledge in some areas, particularly gunnery and engineering, meant that it was critical to grow and reward seniority in those areas, which was not done during the Age of Sail. The technological acceleration would begin in the 1860s, when the Royal Navy began to transition to steam-powered ironclads. This gave naval ships a powerful set of new abilities, like complete freedom of movement. But it also was a change that was resisted by many. The number one reason that admirals resisted the change over to steam power was because it tied them to ports where they could reload with coal. This cut down on the endurance of ships, either in cruising or on station, and was a major problem with the early steam-powered ships that used early steam power engines that were not necessarily very efficient, and so they used a lot of coal. This was a huge change from sail-based propulsion, which, given a few extra ships able to maybe bring food aboard, allowed for almost unlimited endurance at sea. For a number of decades, the sail and steam would kind of coexist. It would be at this point that you see ships that have steam-powered engines but also have sails at the same time. The theory was that this arrangement would provide better endurance because the ship could use its sails when the wind was available, saving coal for when it was not. This worked for a while, but as ships became heavier and heavier and then they started to be fitted with twin screws for propulsion, the drag just became too high for sails to really be any help at all, even under the most perfect of conditions. It would not be until 1887 that the British would stop allowing sails on their battleships, and they would persist on smaller ships for several more years. There would be a tremendous number of tactical ramifications to the introduction of steam power. Most importantly, the relative positions of fleets at sea lost most of its importance. There were still advantages to being on the correct side of, say, the wind, or to being on the correct side of the sun in relative to your opponent, but it was no longer the advantage that it once was. There were also changes aboard the ships. During the Age of Sail, there had been any number of tasks that took constant time and work by the crews, mending and fixing sails and ropes, other such busy work. With the introduction of steam engines, the number of these tasks, the kind of the busy work tasks, were greatly reduced, and so the ship captains tried to find another way to keep the men busy. This often resulted in an almost obsessive desire to keep the ship clean. Cleaning, painting, polishing, all became very important. In this constant battle to keep the ship clean, the men were fighting the long defeat, for sure, against the coal-fired engines, which kind of, had thick black clouds of smoke, which constantly fouled everything, but they would fight, for generations. During these epic battles, they might polish the entire ship, only to see it almost immediately soiled by smoke or just from sea spray, and so the cleaning and polishing would begin again. Another problem when it came to keeping the ship clean was gunnery practice. Gunnery practice was not only not pursued with vigor by many captains of the Royal Navy, it was often actively avoided. There were accounts of captains throwing shells overboard to prevent having to complete the requisite amount of test firing while still being able to claim that the shells were used. The core of the problem was that the captains felt sort of required, due to how ships were judged, to repaint ships after large-scale firing exercises, but these repaints often had to be paid for by the officers themselves. Now, the Royal Navy did pay for 3 repaints for a ship every year, but those were often used in scheduled sort of maintenance periods. Those from firing exercises were more frequent, with each repaint costing upwards of £10,000 for the largest ships. There was a real economic incentive for officers to avoid firing their guns as much as possible. I do just want to make it clear here that while I'm certainly criticizing the officers for prioritizing painting, my greater criticism is reserved for the Royal Navy as a whole. These captains were being judged both by their superiors and by the service as a whole based on the cleanliness of their ships. Officers, or everybody out there listening to this right now, if you're being judged on certain things, you will change your actions to fit however you're being judged. If they are being judged based on how clean their ships are, and they can find a way to forego gunnery practice to keep the ship clean, then they will. If nothing else, it shows that they were good at optimizing. Good job, officers. Another fact that I found interesting about this gunnery practice is that even in the 1880s, it's very different from what would happen during the First World War. While the guns on board ships in the 1880s had ranges of several thousand meters, in a time before any form of fire control, it was impossible to hit anything at that distance. And so the maximum effective engagement ranges were only somewhere around 1,000 meters. This was not much different than during Nelson's time, really, where the general idea was to be a few hundred meters from the enemy before firing. But this would drastically change by the time of the First World War and after. And at Jutland, ships would engage at over 17,000 meters. This massive increase in engagement ranges would be yet another factor that the Royal Navy would have to find a way to adapt to. And it's something that we're actually going to talk a lot about later in this series in episode 9. But while the emphasis on keeping a clean ship would be one feature of the post-Napoleonic Royal Navy, the larger and more pervasive emphasis was on increasing the amount of control that could be exercised both on the fleet as a whole, but also upon individual ships. When looking back at the great victories during the Napoleonic Wars, the British leaders of the Victorian age came to the conclusion that the triumphs were due to the brilliance of a leader and superb execution by his subordinates. This was true, but not quite in the way that they expected. They generally believed that naval warfare could be perfected, and that it could be perfectly directed and controlled by a central leader, and through this control, success could be guaranteed. At some level, this idea has always been tempting for all military leaders. If the correct course can be identified by a high-level officer or the highest-level officer, and then every subordinate officer just follows the exact plan, it should be much easier to position units, concentrate efforts, and be prepared for enemy action. The fact that this was completely against what Nelson believed, he being an officer that famously rebelled against orders several times, was beside the point. The tendency to favor exact control of actions came not only from senior officers, but also from political leaders in London. A major milestone in political control of the Navy would occur with the passage of the Military Discipline Act of 1864. This put limits on the ability of ships' captains to discipline the sailors aboard their vessels. It would be one of many forms of control exercised by leaders in London. These forms of control often came in the form of, well, forms, paperwork. Adding many levels of paperwork was seen as a way to control both the actions of the leaders at sea and in port. This came in many forms, with even simple things, like requisition forms, seen as a good way of keeping the power of the captain, the navy, and the naval budget in check. Not all of these forms of control were bad, you know, standardizing disciplinary actions, ensuring money was being spent correctly. Those aren't bad things, they aren't bad actions in and of themselves. But they shifted the focus and structure of the Royal Navy in subtle and largely irreversible ways.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hello, this is Matt from the Explorers Podcast. I want to invite you to join me on the voyages and journeys of the most famous explorers in the history of the world. At the Explorers Podcast, we plunge into jungles and deserts, across mighty oceans and frigid ice caps, over and to the top of great mountains, and even into outer space. These are the thrilling and captivating stories of Magellan, Shackleton, Lewis and Clark, and so many other famous and not so famous adventurers from throughout history. So come give us a listen. We'd love to have you. Go to explorerspodcast.com. Or just look us up on your podcast app. That's the Explorers Podcast.
into this well-entrenched tradition of control entered Vice Admiral Sir George Tryon. In 1891, Tryon would go to Malta to take command of the Mediterranean fleet. At this point in history, the Mediterranean fleet was the most senior command in the Royal Navy. This was a time before the creation of the clearly primary home fleet in the years before the First World War. A command as prestigious as the Mediterranean fleet being taken up by Tryon was important because Tryon was a reformer. Tryon would be deeply critical of the Royal Navy's reliance on signaling. In the preceding decades, there had been a growing movement towards exercising precise control of all ships in a fleet from the flagship. At the same time, in the years before radio, the only method for doing these communications were signal flags. This worked really well while the fleet was on maneuvers. The ships all knew to look to the flagship, they could generally see the signal, there was no enemy to interfere with their receipt or execution of the signals, there was no smoke, there was no firing. But Tryon's core concern was that these conditions were not indicative of what would be found during a combat situation. He would raise simple questions like, quote, "What happens if the flagship's signal hoists are destroyed?" But also more important questions like, what if the admiral in charge does not have all of the available information? You know, if he can't have all the information, then he can't make the right decision. Tryon also had a physical thing that he kind of directly criticized, and it was the signaling book. This was a published list of signals from the Admiralty that seemed to be constantly growing. It allowed for precise movements of the fleet to be dictated from a central authority. These kinds of orders and their execution were known as steam tactics, and they were made possible due to the switch to steam-powered engines. In the age of sail, precise movements were not always exactly possible, due to kind of the vagaries of the wind, a problem that was no longer a concern in the age of self-propulsion. If an admiral wanted ship A to turn precisely 3 degrees to port and proceed at 5 knots, while ship B turned 12 degrees to starboard and set speed for 12 knots, while ship C did something different, etc., etc., all of that could absolutely happen in a fleet of steam-powered warships. As long as the signalers did not collapse in exhaustion and they were given sufficient time, these types of incredibly intricate orders could be given. To try and make signaling like this easier, if a specific type of maneuver was done frequently, it was then codified in the signaling book, which by 1874 was 300 pages in length. Much like the cult of clean, the cult of precise maneuver became not just an ability that was expected from captains, it became the most important showcase of a captain's abilities. Specific orders and specific movements came no longer to be seen just as something done during exercises, but the only way that actions could be executed. As the combat experience of the Royal Navy began to approach zero in the late 1800s, it would also become the only way that the fleet could execute really anything. In 1886, the Admiralty began a new revision of the signal book. When the draft was completed, it had to be printed in 2 volumes, because combined, it was a length of 500 pages. When he took command of the Mediterranean fleet, Tryon did not really question that the signaling book was needed. Ships did need to know how to communicate with one another. His core complaint was that it was almost entirely useless in a combat situation. It would just take too long and was too vulnerable to changes in visibility or enemy actions to be at all useful in the presence of enemy ships. He would write his opinion of the signal book and how he planned to improve upon it like this. Quote, "I regard the mass of these books as barrack yard goose-step parade drill books, most necessary and important as preliminaries leading up to other things. They teach principles necessary in maneuvering, how ships can in very close order be safely maneuvered. They inspire confidence to those not accustomed to ride fresh horses in company. But once outside the barrack yard, we come face to face with an opponent whose views may or may not be able to be the same as our customs. We should be in a position to take initiative and to force his hands, and the admiral, who has his fleet best in hand and most mobile, will have a great pull. In action, the drill book should be put to one side and sat on, the compass only in use for navigation purposes. I don't say it is perfect, nothing is, but I am convinced it is a step in the right direction. I don't think men should be set to construct signal books or to formulate systems of maneuvers without being acquainted with what is wanted. We want signal books to give us what we want. We do not want to be dragooned by signal books." End quote. The system of trying to reintroduce a captain's initiative to fleet actions would be called the TA system. This was derived from the signal for TA, which Tryon would hoist on his ship to let the others know that the fleet was moving from detailed order mode to a less detailed one. When the signal was hoisted, and while the fleet was in TA mode, the captains of their ships had to be a bit more observant of the situation around them, but they could still expect some orders from the flagship, just not orders that told them precisely what to do. There were, for example, 8 one-flag signals created for simple but frequent fleet actions, like moving from abreast to line left or line right. It was expected that such a simple signal was all that would be required for a captain to judge his environment and take the appropriate actions. A good example of how this changed the course of communications was an exercise done shortly after the TA system was introduced. During the test, the 1st Division of the fleet was put through a series of 13 turns and formation changes. To do this movement by the signal book would have required 35 flags by the flagship, 93 flags from the surrounding ships to repeat it, and 74 to then answer it. Under the new TA rules, it was done in 10 total flags, 10 instead of 202. Now, this was not a completely fair test, as the maneuvers had specifically been chosen due to the ease of signaling in the TA system, but that was also the point, to take some of the most essential maneuvers and movements that were expected in combat and distill them down to be as simple as possible. Throughout 1892, the fleet would train under the new TA system, and they got better. Experience was key in the TA system, because it put so much power back in the hands of individual captains. Instead of just following orders, they now had to be in constant vigilance of their surroundings, and they were more responsible for the safety of their own ship. They also had to know and consider the overall goal of the fleet and how best they could contribute to it. Instead of one admiral trying to control the actions of the ships under his command, the captains themselves had a tremendous amount of responsibility to ensure that their ships were doing the right thing to contribute to the success. To go along with this new responsibility, they were also given a much broader power to make more decisions themselves. This would prove to be too much for some officers who had spent their entire career under the old system. There would also be some officers who were fully in support of these changes, and others that only went along with them due to the fact that they were orders from a superior officer, so they kind of had to do them. Unfortunately for the future of the TA system, and decentralized command as a whole in the Royal Navy, in 1893, just as the fleet was reaching new levels of ability under the TA system, a mistake would be made, a really, really big mistake, that would erase much of the forward progress made by Tryon, and would also cost him his life. The Mediterranean fleet would leave its home waters of Valletta in Malta on May 27, 1893, and for almost a month it would perform maneuvers. On June 22nd, Vice Admiral Tryon would have the ships arrayed in 2 columns, columns that were sailing 6 cables apart. A cable is about 1/10 of a mile, so they were sailing about 6/10 of a mile apart, roughly 1 kilometer. Tryon would give orders for the 2 columns to execute a simultaneous inward turn. This would bring them together, sailing the opposite direction, but much closer together. The 2 officers who received the order brought up one small problem. The 2 lines would require 7.5 cables in distance to execute this turn without colliding, but they were only 6 apart. Tryon confirmed the order, and so it was sent. The outcome was inevitable. When the 2 lines of ships turned, the lead ship of the 2nd column collided with the HMS Victoria, Tryon's flagship. It was quickly clear that the Victoria was going to sink, and actions were taken to abandon ship. Unfortunately, out of a crew of around 600, 350 men would not be rescued. Among them were Tryon himself, one of the very few British admirals to go down with his ship on a training exercise. On June 23rd, news would arrive in London that the collision had occurred, and that hundreds were dead, and the Victoria had sunk. The reaction to this news was shock. A court-martial was set up in Malta for Victoria's officers for the loss of their ship, and also to determine what had happened. One interesting feature of this new court-martial was that it was well reported on in the press due to the ability of people on the scene to telegraph information back to London. There were a few things that became very clear almost immediately. Tryon had miscalculated, and it was his fault that the ships had collided. Rear Admiral Markham, who had been in command of the ship that had hit the Victoria, should not be blamed, as it would be harmful to the future of the Royal Navy to blame an officer for carrying out the orders of his superior, or that was their logic anyway. Along with this official verdict, there were also other changes that would be made that by those that would succeed Tryon. Vice Admiral Colm Seymour would arrive to take command of the fleet in Malta, and he would exercise a far more conservative command style, with the fleet reverting back to sole use of the signal book for its maneuvering. It was clear that this was motivated by those who still disliked Tryon's reformist nature because when the Victoria had been hit, the fleet had not even been sailing under his TA rules. If it had been, the collision might not have happened at all. But this little detail did not really matter, though. And with Tryon out of the way, the other senior leaders in the Navy sought to remove the TA system from the practices of the Navy. It became a useful scapegoat. However, the ideas of Tryon would live on, and the conflict between those who believed in a more fluid type of command and those who wanted to continue issuing specific orders would go on to play a critical role over the next several decades, most famously at the Battle of Jutland. At the battle, Jellicoe would represent the more conservative style of command, very precise orders, very precise control. On the other hand would be Admiral Beatty, who generally just expected his captains to react to whatever he was doing, and to use their judgment when doing so. The difference in these command styles and the unfortunate position of the 5th Battle Squadron and Rear Admiral Sir Evan Thomas would be much discussed in the months after Jutland. That was all in the future, though, and in the late 1890s, the Royal Navy, even if its confidence was slightly shaken by this Victoria incident, was still the greatest navy in the world. It outnumbered the next 5 navies combined. It held a lead in technology and shipbuilding. In the decades between 1860 and 1900, there was a lot of experimentation in warship design, not just with steam power, but how many guns, where to put them, how to armor the ship. Just about every area of naval design was either questioned or drastically altered. By the last years of the 1800s, battleships would continue to get more and more powerful, with larger and more capable guns. While these changes would not have the impact of, say, the Dreadnought in 1906, they would still result in the rapid obsolescence of several generations of Royal Navy ships. This was partly due to the construction efforts of other navies, with construction programs in France and Russia in the years before 1900 causing some concern. Those two nations would order several armored battleships, which would be largely impervious to all but the largest of the guns mounted on British battleships. This prompted large increases in the money being spent on new naval construction, with the budget just on battleship construction being increased from £16.8 million in 1896 to almost £30 million a few years later. Even with this broad support, which the Royal Navy could always count on politically and publicly, such large increases in the budgetary requirement for the Navy were bound to cause discussions. Pressure began to build for tighter budget controls, or at least an end to the constant budgetary expansion required by the Royal Navy. But any budgetary reforms had to contend with the seemingly endless acceleration of technological change. All of this meant that whether it wanted to or not, the Royal Navy was going to have to change, and in major ways that would be resisted by some members, not just of the Navy themselves, but in the halls of power in London. To make these changes and to lead a revolution in naval technology would require a new leader, and that leader would come in the form of Admiral Sir Jackie Fisher. Fisher would become First Lord of the Admiralty in 1905, and he would completely alter the makeup of the Royal Navy, and in some ways, the history of naval warfare, in just a few years. And that will be our story for next episode.